Welcome to,
or welcome back to,
Dark Room Reviews. My name is Ginger.
And I'm Matt.
In this week's episode of Horror Movie Reviews, we'll be examining the timeless classic and my personal favorite,
The Shining. Let's give you a bit of background here. The Shining came out in 1980, directed by Stanley Kubrick. It stars Jack Nicholson as Jack Torrance, Shelley Duvall as Wendy Torrance, Danny Lloyd as Danny Torrance, and Scatman Crothers as Dick Halloran. The film was based on the novel The Shining, written by Stephen King. It's a creepy psychological thriller about a family trapped in isolation.
Hashtag relevant content.
As well as a few angry spirits.
Okay. I would have to say, again, hard to pick a personal favorite for a movie just because, wow, what a broad subject matter. But I do have to think that it might actually be my favorite horror movie of all time.
That being said, doesn't mean we shouldn't review it, give it a few talking points.
Yeah, because as much as I do love about it and I want to talk about those things and praise it for those things, there are actually a couple things in here that I am, you know, looking back at it with maybe my modern lens and going, that's not the best.
A little interesting way.
Yeah.
So to give you an idea of what we're going to do here, we are going to start at the beginning and work through the film and give you our personal opinions on what we think of these, or this movie in particular.
Yeah, and we will say, spoiler alert, so for this podcast and basically
future
this episode,
ones.
Yeah, and all the other episodes, there will be heavy spoilers. I don't think many people would call themselves a horror movie lover and be listening to this podcast not having seen The Shining, but we still want to say that even for
this movie.
Just
in case, you're going to get a lot of info.
Yes. So, warning, spoiler alert.
And at the very end, we will give our kind of tally of score and give you our personal review of what we think of The Shining. Let's get started at the beginning.
All right. So, first, I just want to start right at the very beginning, the opening credits. For me, I absolutely love this style. The scenery is awesome. It's breathtaking. They show you those really great aerial flying mountain shots.
Which wasn't really done the whole lot at that time.
Yeah.
It's pretty expensive to do that.
It was extremely expensive to do that, and it's just really well done. And then I think the biggest thing that we can talk about, that while you're getting that beautiful secluded scenery, is that music.
Yes.
That music choice was, for me, perfect. Now, what do you think about it just being,
I do think it was a really good choice. I know Stanley Kubrick was really weird about original music.
Yes.
He had what we call in the music film industry a bit of temp score love.
Right.
Stanley Kubrick didn't love some original music, or if he did get original music, he always wanted it to sound exactly like something else.
Yeah.
So I do believe for this one, he did use 21st century modern piece, where you do get those kind of weird high strings, some of the chords that don't really make sense, some of the more edgy harmonics that are just, for the more normal person listening ear, is a little uncomfortable and uneasy.
Yeah, and over top of that score, you even get the, they throw in some background kind of sounds that are kind of like howling. Really well done to put that over top of that piece
and
of music.
And especially for the time, like, sound design and sound effects now are full positions and full things that are required in every film. That wasn't necessarily something that was really done that often for films of that era.
Yeah.
They tended to do a little bit more traditional stuff. But that being said, it really does open up and really set the mood for the rest of the film.
Yeah, and it does it so well. Like, right off the bat, you know it's going to be creepy. I think we can also talk about just the way that the credits are done. They do the kind of very old-fashioned thing.
Yeah, credits first.
Credits first, yeah. Which I like. In the right movie, I do like it.
And now it's starting to make a comeback.
I know,
actually see a few films where they start showing some stuff at the beginning.
Yeah.
But We'll see how that trend goes. I'm neither for or against it.
Yeah, in the right movie, I really like it. Mm-hmm. This is one of those.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right after the opening credits, we kind of get right into the movie. They start you off with what we like to refer to as the interview scene. And this is where you get the first introduction of our main character, Jack Torrance, played, like we said, by Jack Nicholson. And he's interviewing for the position of caretaker, winter caretaker, at the Overlook Hotel. You can tell that it's set somewhere in the, it looks like the Colorado Rockies. And you can also tell that, generally speaking, Jack and his family have been living in, or at least most recently have been living in...
In the city of Denver. Denver,
right. So he's interviewing for this position, and the interview seems to be going pretty well. You know, they got
a little back and forth going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, they've got, seems what,
and then for. Not out of left field, but because, you know, it's a horror film. They got to give you some type of background info.
Yeah.
This is where we really start to learn about what happened to the previous family.
Yeah. So it wasn't the most recent family that had been caretakers there, but they do mention that it had been, what did they give you for a timeline? I think they said...
A few years?
I think it was somewhere closer to 10 years ago. So... Still within a reasonable amount of time, but essentially this manager is telling of a situation where his predecessor in the job had to deal with this truly horrific event, which was one of the winter caretakers, very similar to Jack Torrance's position, brought his family with him to the hotel for the winter. So he brought his wife and two girls. And essentially he explains of the story where the man has a complete mental breakdown.
Yes, he got a bad case of cabin fever, called it at the time.
Yeah.
And lost his mind and ended up killing his family.
Yeah.
And then killed himself.
Yes. He, just the way he describes it, first of all, they don't hold back on all the details. I mean, he describes it as chopped them into little pieces, stacked them neatly in a closet, and then blew his brains out with both barrels of a shotgun. That's, I think, almost a direct quote. Pretty intense story just right off the bat. And you can tell right away, again, something I like from it, is that Jack is quite obviously disturbed by this story. He's not stopped. He's not going to not take the position, but he's definitely sitting there going, wow, that's quite the story. That's a lot to happen in a place. But you can also tell that he's thinking, that's not going to happen to me. So, mm-hmm. It's just a story. It's just a thing that happened here. Now, he also mentions, the manager also mentions, you might want to tell your wife about this. Maybe you'll give her second thoughts. And he says, well, quite the contrary, actually. She's Wendy Torrance, that's his wife, is a bit of a horror movie and ghost story buff, essentially. That's what he's calling her. Now, interestingly enough, it doesn't actually show Jack telling Wendy about what had gone down at the hotel.
Yeah, I don't think he actually ever does.
No. I don't know. What's your take on that? What do you think about that?
I don't know. Like, I do get the understanding of, like, not wanting to worry someone necessarily, because you're like, oh, we don't know what happened to this guy.
Right.
And especially with all what they had was, oh, cabin fever went crazy. And you're like, well, how can I go crazy? Got all these things to do.
Yeah.
And Jack kind of says, like, well, that's not going to happen to me because I got my book. I have all this work I have to do.
Right.
I don't know. In some ways, I could almost say, like, not tell them because, you know.
You don't think it's malicious intent. You don't think it's like,
no, not at this
I'm
point.
Not going to tell her.
No, I do think that it does strike me as a little odd because there are other things that he almost pushes Wendy unnecessarily in certain scenes that we can talk about later.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily love every interaction between Jack and Wendy.
Yeah.
I think it's just a little too much for me and kind of takes away from the actual storyline, but we'll get to those scenes when we get to them.
Yeah.
But I do overall like the pacing and the idea of, you know, this exposition through the interview.
Yeah.
I think it's a good way of keeping Jack's story in while giving you some back information, and it's not too long, the pacing's good on it.
I agree with that too. Jack's whole thing is that he is essentially, he's been teaching. That's how he sort of makes ends meet. But really what he wants to do is get back into his real passion, which is writing. Hello, Stephen King. A little bit of maybe some personal life in there injected into the story. And he says that, you know, this is going to be the great place to, you know, outline his next writing project.
Spoiler, it's not.
Spoiler alert, it doesn't happen. That's essentially his, I think that's his reasoning for wanting to take, you know, such an odd job. So then
well,
from there...
Well, now we start getting into some weird stuff.
Yeah.
We start to get into some of Jack's family, and more particularly Danny, which kind of this whole story eventually does revolve around.
Right. So next they show you the rest of the family, which, like we said, is Danny Torrance, that's the son, and Wendy Torrance, that's Jack's wife. So it shows Danny and Wendy, they're back at their, what looks like their Denver apartment, and they're just having some lunch and just sort of generally interacting. It's a nice scene. Like, they seem to have a good, you know, at least a good interaction as mother and son. Then you kind of get introduced to some sort of some interesting things. So you are introduced to the fact that Danny has an imaginary friend who he calls Tony. That's all you really know about it so far. But again, seems pretty innocent. I will say that. It doesn't...
Well, most kids have imaginary friends at some point or another.
Exactly. After lunch, Danny's just sort of in the bathroom. He's sort of absent-mindedly. He's looking at himself in the mirror. He's playing in water. He's like, maybe just finished brushing his teeth or something. And he's talking to Tony. And basically, Tony is relaying to Danny that Jack is calling Wendy, telling her that he got the job and they're gonna go live in that hotel. And essentially you're getting the idea that Tony doesn't want him to go to that hotel, or he wants him to be afraid of that hotel, because in that moment Danny is getting scenes, you're getting these hard cuts and these flashes
of different scenes happening.
And
the biggest one being the iconic Shining scene where the elevator doors open up and the blood pours out into the lobby.
Yeah. And you don't know.
You don't know why. You don't know what's happened. You don't know what's going on.
No.
You just get these images. And I do think that's a very effective way to do it. Again, you're trying to give people bits and pieces while still leaving them a little confused and anxious as to what's to happen next.
Yeah. It's a nice way to be on edge, but that it's not coming out of left field. Totally. It's a good little intro into the horror events that are about to unfold in the movie. So then from there, Danny does look scared. He does a really good job of looking really scared. And in the next scene, he's fainted and he's being woken up to a doctor doing a house call, obviously because his mom, Wendy, was pretty concerned about him fainting like that. And he explains to the doctor that basically he was just brushing his teeth and talking to Tony. And she says, well, who's Tony? And he explains that's his imaginary friend and that, you know, Tony tells him stuff, but, you know, he doesn't really want to talk about it. He's like, he's a little shy about it, which again, I think is...
Yeah, it's pretty typical
for
a kid.
Yeah, it's not super abnormal. You're not getting this sense that, like, Danny is, you know, creepy or something to be afraid of. Like, it's just, you're just getting that he's just a little different, and that's okay. You know, Wendy is a good concerned mom in these scenes. Like, you know, when she has the one-on-one interaction with the doctor, you can tell that she's very relieved when the doctor says there's nothing wrong with him. He's just, these episodes happen with kids.
And
you know?
Going back to Wendy's reaction, I do think that Shelley Duvall did a really good job with a lot of her scenes.
Yes.
Now, again, I will mention later that some of the direction with her character I don't necessarily agree with, or some of the interactions with Jack's character.
Yeah.
I find in certain scenes it does get a little too almost melodramatic and whiny or unnecessarily edgy, but we'll get to that when we get to those scenes.
But I will say, like, I totally agree. I actually like her as a choice, like a casting choice for this role. And I like her scenes, her interactions with Danny. Like, she does look, she's acting quite motherly and it's nice. Like, there's a nice relationship there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And she seems very genuine and very caring.
To talk about one of the scenes I don't love with their relationship is the next one coming up, which is where they're on their way to the Overlook Hotel.
Yes.
Now, I think this scene has its purpose.
Yeah.
I think that it might have just missed the mark for me.
Yes.
So
character-wise, it missed
the mark. Character-wise, missed the mark. But I can maybe see what they were going for.
Yeah.
So on the car ride up, you are seeing it's just Jack, Wendy, and Danny in the car. And they're just kind of chatting about what they're looking forward to, kind of what's going to, you know, their new adventure together as a family up at the Overlook Hotel, and where everyone's kind of getting a new start. They're out of Denver. And they're trying to make some, like, lighthearted comments. And at this point, we don't have anything to really say that Jack doesn't like Wendy. As far as we know, he's gently caring.
Yeah.
Seems to, like, have called her up for the, like, about the job. Seems to care about Danny. But then we get to this car scene, and he is just unnecessarily edgy rude and snappy.
And
I'm just, it's a little out of left field for me. And then you get to Wendy's character, where she almost comes across as, like, the damsel in distress, the ditzy damsel who doesn't know anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Even the way she asks normal questions almost make it seem like she doesn't know anything.
Yeah.
And I don't love that direction, because I don't think that's the way Wendy's character is supposed to be portrayed.
No, I don't think so either. Like, I guess what they're trying to portray is some awkwardness in their relationship. Because at this point, you know that Jack Torrance he doesn't drink, or both him and Wendy don't drink. And you kind of get the impression from the interaction with Wendy and the doctor that Jack did have a problem with alcohol. He actually caused an injury to Danny. You get told he had dislocated Danny's shoulder, and that's why they'd kept him out of daycare. Basically from this incident, Jack decides to give up alcohol, and he says, "I won't touch a drop," and he hasn't touched a drop in, I think she says, 5 months or something like that. It's months, it's not years, but essentially he has given up alcohol because he clearly did have at least a problem, or at least the start of a problem. But I think all they're trying to show is that there's still
some imperfections in their relationship.
And some uncomfortableness and some awkwardness between the two of them. However, it just comes across as rude and snappy. Because all she's doing, she basically, this whole thing, the whole thing that we're talking about. She asked the question of, is this where the Donner Party got stranded? And he says, no, I think it was in a different area. And then
it's like awkward silence for a little while.
And then Danny brings up, who were the Donner Party? And, you know, Jack explains, oh, they were a group of settlers in covered wagon times that got snowbound, and they ran out of food and had to resort to cannibalism to stay alive. And it's right at that point where Danny's saying, like, oh, they eat each other up. And he's like, yep. And again, she's
a little concerned, like, oh, like, where do you know this? Where does my young child know about cannibalism?
And she does something like, Jack,
don't worry, Mom. I know all about cannibalism. I saw it on TV.
See? It's okay. You saw it on the television.
You know, because she's doing that typical mom thing of, like,
trying to protect their kid. Don't tell them about the scary things.
Don't talk to our child about cannibalism. You know, even though he clearly does know about it on his own. Like, he might not have known that word, but he kind of knew about it a little bit. You know, and he says, don't worry, Mom, I heard it on
television. Yeah, I heard it from television.
And he says, see? He heard it from the television. So it's okay. And he's just so over the top and so
unnecessarily rude and dramatic to Wendy. Nothing's happened. Jack is supposed to be this person. Nothing's happened to him yet. They're not even at the hotel.
No, they're not at the hotel. He's not under the influence of the hotel yet. And for all you know, he had his issues with the substance abuse, with alcohol. But for all you know, he's been sober for those months, like Wendy says. And he's been generally a good father otherwise. And good father, good husband otherwise. And you're like, oh man, that's a little harsh for just supposed to be a lighthearted conversation. And just the way his reactions are, he's like, yes. Like, every time she asks him a question, he's like,
annoyed or irritated.
Yes. Like, there's this sigh and this, like, look on his face. And part of it is that Jack Nicholson himself, just as a person, does look extremely expressive. Like, everything you can tell he's feeling is coming out through his face, which is really cool if you're an actor.
Well, and especially for later scenes in the movie, it's very useful.
Oh my gosh, is he... I mean, he's just so perfect in those later scenes. But for this, where... Yeah, where... especially if you're falling back to the source material, which is the book, he's supposed to be a good husband, good father at this point. Yes, he's made his mistakes, but he's... supposed to be just your average person.
Yeah. And I think a better approach to this scene would have been something where it's not perfect. Maybe they're a little on edge, but it's more excitement, looking forward to it, and they're still trying to maintain that family unit.
Yeah.
There can still be some awkwardness. There can be some things, because, again, the whole idea is that there have been some struggles in the relationship, yes. But
I think they could have
nothing's
done it
happened
better.
Yet. They're not at the hotel.
No, and I think they could have done that better, just showing maybe some... maybe some disjointedness in their relationship would have been better, but maybe not that extreme edginess. Anyway, it's not a super pivotal part of the movie or anything. It's just that we like kind of bringing it up because, like, wow, can you ever tell? Now, something else we want to mention, just a little bit of a side tangent with that. We did want to mention that maybe it had to do with how the real life Shelley Duvall and Jack Nicholson, maybe they just truly didn't get along that well. We do know now that, you know, it's gone on, I mean, obviously this is decades later, but now it's sort of come out over the years that Stanley Kubrick did not treat Shelley Duvall well at all. He was very cruel, he was very demanding, he yelled on set a lot, and he demanded absolute perfection that, you know, for better or worse, she wasn't delivering what he wanted. And that's not fair. She really did kind of suffer during the filming of this movie. It's come out that she wasn't eating, she wasn't sleeping, she was losing her hair. And again, we've also learned over the years that Shelley Duvall has had some of her own personal issues, but that's not right. You know, that's not an appropriate way to treat an actor on set. And we also know that Stanley Kubrick had a great relationship with Jack Nicholson. He really loved just everything about him. They got along really well. They would have considered them friends. And they worked extremely well together. And you do have to wonder if some of that was also bleeding into...
Yeah, the treatment of Shelley and her character as Wendy.
Shelley, yeah. If it wasn't just a direction choice, if it might have just been... this is how the real person feels about this other real person, not actors in a situation. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know, it's food for thought, it's something to think about. Maybe that was going on, you know. Just because you're a good actor doesn't mean that you're not fully able to ignore your true feelings towards
or maybe your direction, the director, in this case, Stanley Kubrick, had unintentionally or intentionally went this way because of the way he felt about her.
Influenced the situation because of his own personal feelings towards her. We don't know, but it's something to bring up anyway. Next thing we kind of wanted to talk about was the series of scenes that we kind of like to refer to as the hotel walkthrough. So this is where the family has arrived at the Overlook Hotel. It's clearly the last day or second to last day that guests and other employees are allowed to be there. And they close up the Overlook Hotel for the season. Wendy raises the question of, like, oh, I think, wouldn't this place be the perfect set for, you know, a ski resort, something like that? And to which they say, you know, when the hotel was built, there was very little or no interest in winter sports. So then it was picked, the hotel location was picked for its extreme, like, seclusion and scenery and picturesque beauty and all that kind of stuff. But because of that, because it's so isolated.
So remote and isolated.
Yeah. It's on this series of highway that would just be an absolute nightmare to keep clear of snow. And I think he mentions they get like 15 to 20 feet of snow cumulative over the entire winter. And that's just, yeah, it's just not like financially feasible for them to keep that clear safely so that people could come and go. So then that's kind of why they're, I get it, it's a good way of sort of bridging that gap of saying, like, well, this is why the hotel is so remote and also why they
need
a winter caretaker.
Yeah,
so they do a good job of explaining that. They do some things in this next series of scenes that I like, and they also do some things that I don't particularly care for. So a lot of it is exposition. A lot of it is just telling you.
It's a lot of historical background, just facts, things that have happened at the hotel, things that are going to get you set up for the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
Now, That being said, I don't hate the way they've done this.
No.
Because they, again, they've tied it well into the story of needing, like, there is a real point to having a hotel walkthrough, especially if you haven't stayed there and you're going to be the only one there for the winter months.
Yeah.
So I do like that idea of factoring that in while giving you some background info as to what's going on.
Yeah, you would totally have to show them around the entirety of the hotel. Show them the actual details of the job, like the true job itself, because there are some things you do have to make sure that the hotel is heated properly, because they can't have certain part of it freeze and have the pipes burst and all these things. And also keeping up with, like, maintenance, winter maintenance, things that happen, which makes sense. You know, you get extreme...
Make sure the boiler doesn't break down on you.
Yes, the boiler. Why are you mentioning the boiler?
Yeah, no reason. I think it might be important.
Yeah, no reason at all. They do these things that are definitely necessary, but then while they're doing these things, they also talk about the kind of historical details, and I am doing air quotes with that, with the Overlook Hotel. The Overlook Hotel, by the way, isn't a real hotel in a true sense. Now, there was a real hotel that Stephen King did visit, and it is where he got a lot of the inspiration for the novel that he wrote, The Shining. He actually claims that he wrote it, for all intents and purposes, in one night. In one horribly sleepless night that he claims that basically he had this haunting experience in this particular hotel, and subsequently wrote The Shining, which is, I think, really interesting. Yeah. So the real-life hotel that you could say Stephen King is basing it off of is the Stanley Hotel. Having said that, though, the exterior shots are one thing used for the movie. Those are just exterior shots of a hotel. And the interior shots of all the movie...
all the sets.
Yeah, all the sets, those are actual studio sets. Those were created by Stanley Kubrick and his people. And I think actually all of them were in England. Because at that time, I don't think Kubrick was traveling. He was kind of known to be extremely afraid of flying. And I think at that point, he was pretty permanently in England, if I remember correctly.
Well, getting back to the walkthrough now.
Yeah.
So, things I like about it.
Yes.
Things that I like. I like that they tell you all about the different rooms, all how grand the hotel is, things that you're going to need to know for later scenes in the movie. Yeah. They do it in a way that is really nice.
Yeah.
Now, where I start losing steam is, like, the pacing through the general walkthrough is really good.
Mm.
You're getting some information such as the, quote, Indian burial ground that it's put on.
Which is such
a... We get it, Stephen King.
Oh, such a Stephen King trope, if you will. And my personal feeling on it is I don't like it in this story. Pet Sematary is one for me that I actually like. That tie-in. So basically, like, if you don't know that, but if you do, here's the little overview anyway. So what happens in a very, very brief overview of Pet Sematary is that there is land that is known to Native Americans of this certain area that if you bury something dead in it, whether that's a pet or a person, it will come back to life, but not as the thing that you know it. It has an evil soul, or it's lost its soul. And basically the way that they describe it is the natives of that area considered that ground to be spoiled or soured. And I really like that. Like,
it almost serves a purpose that, there has been this sort of ancient native or somehow old setting of that is still relevant in modern day, whereas I don't like the idea of this burial ground to be almost the root cause. I guess that's kind of what they're going for, but it's never really explicitly explained.
They don't bridge the gap, I will say that. Like, at least in Pet Sematary, you know, for as cheesy as that movie is and as cheesy as the story is, they at least bridge the gap. They tell you that there are
because,
a group of people that think that this ground is sour or spoiled and that this is what happens on this land, and then sure enough it happens, and I at least that's a real tie-in to the story. But in this one, in The Shining, I just find it to be frivolous.
Is like it's haunted or it's horror or it's scary because it is, but then that has no tie-in to that. I don't agree with that either. I think that it is almost just like a fact for the fact of it being a fact.
Yeah, they do mention it.
That walkthrough scene, getting back to my original point, was, I like that you get these facts while they're just kind of meandering through the hotel, learning about the job.
They show you some key rooms, and they do it without it being too cheesy. So, and
being too obvious that these are going to be important.
Yeah.
Rooms. Like, you see the ballrooms, and you see the kitchen, you see the pantry.
Yeah.
You get to see all these things that are...
the hedge maze.
Yeah, and the hedge maze. But how could I forget the hedge maze?
Yeah, and how can you forget the hedge maze? I mean, hello, talk about an important location. So they show you these rooms in a really, like, nice organic way, because they're doing it blended in with a walkthrough, so it's completely natural to get it that way.
Where you start to lose me is later, after Dick Halloran is on the scene and they're talking to Wendy about the cooking preparations, the meal preparations. Yes. And of course, you know, unfortunately for the times, Wendy's going to be doing all the cooking.
Yeah, I think their actual verbiage was, so basically the... Dick Halloran, who is introduced as the head chef at the Overlook Hotel, they're like, oh, Dick, perfect timing. You can take Wendy to the kitchen and show her around the pantries and the freezers and stuff. And it's like, okay. So, yeah, take the woman away to show her the kitchen.
To show her how to cook. Where she is going to be cooking.
Where she is going to be cooking. And I say, okay, fine. We can't criticize it too much because, again, we're looking at it through our 2020
modern vision.
2020 vision. Oh!
I had to.
Dad joke here.
Sorry.
Yeah, so we're looking at it through that lens. And that's, you know, okay.
I get they're trying to do the reveal here. So now after this has all happened, we start to find out that Dick knows to call Danny Doc, which was a family nickname for him, and you're starting to figure out what's going on here. How does he know this?
Yeah, and Wendy even, she notices it. She's like, hey, like, you've called him Doc twice just now, and she's like, I don't think I've used that nickname in your presence.
Yeah, how did you know that it was his nickname? Or...
yeah, so I do like, she's doing a really good job at, like, being like, huh, she noticed, but she's not pushing the subject too much. She's not being weird with it. You can tell that she likes Dick and that they're having a nice interaction. Like, it's not a bad or creepy interaction at all.
We got a dozen jugs of black molasses. We got 60 boxes of dried milk. How'd you like some ice cream, Doc?
But where this loses me is... they go on a really long one-on-one conversation about The Shining, where I'm just like, we get it, exposition.
Yes.
It's just, I understand that it's information you need to have. I just wish it was tied in a little bit better like it was during the walkthrough.
Yeah.
So afterwards, Danny and Wendy go sit down and have some ice cream with Dick.
No, Wendy's not there.
Well, Wendy's not there at that point, but I mean, like, Dick invites him to come in and... Dick sits with Danny as Wendy gets whisked away after.
Well, okay, but let me stop you there. So, I think the thing that I like about it is how it's first introduced that there's even anything special to Dick. So, the cool thing that I like about that scene is that while Dick is having this extremely mundane conversation to Wendy, showing her the pantry, they're just prattling on about stuff, he is... The kind of the creepy music sets in, you can hear that heartbeat sound in the background, and he asks Danny, telepathically, do you want some ice cream, Doc? And Danny looks surprised, but not scared, but just surprised, rightfully so.
I like the introduction.
Yes.
I don't love
the subsequent
the 12
conversation.
To 15 minute scene of... this is The Shining, this is this, this is this, this is the hotel.
Yeah.
It's just, oh, right. If they had maybe brought it through
with
a walkthrough or, like, again, especially when you start getting into the room 237 stuff, like, what if they were walking by the hotel and somehow Danny picked up on it and that's how that subject's brought
up? Yeah, that's fair. I like that... that it's Dick that basically names what The Shining even is. I think that's really cool. But you're right, that scene does kind of drag on just a little too long.
And it just loses me with the pacing, especially when they did such a good job earlier with the walkthrough.
Oh, the pacing is so well done earlier with the walkthrough, and then just the scene happens, and it comes to a crashing halt Having said that, though, they do mention room 237, and essentially Dick Halloran says to stay away from that room, but also that there's nothing in room 237, which I find to be a little bit of a mixed message personally, because it's funny, and Danny definitely picks up on it. He's like, so you're afraid of that room? And he's like, no, I'm not afraid of that room, but stay away from that room. So, bit of an odd message there. Then we get, it moves right along, and I do like this, so now we're kind of back into some better pacing.
Well, because the exposition ended.
Yeah.
Thanks, Stephen King.
Yes, thank you. The exposition is finally over. So now it does a nice little time jump. It says 1 month later. And what it does is it sort of shows you what's been happening with the family, them getting adjusted to being in this hotel. And, you know, you can see Wendy going on her daily activities. She's making breakfast for them, and she's cooking, and she's doing all these things. And she's doing some exploring on her own. It independently shows Danny riding
in his big wheel.
Yeah, riding around in this big wheel, which I think is exactly what you would do if you were a kid in a hotel.
Pretty
fearless kid, though.
That's what I mean.
Pretty fearless,
like,
yeah.
He goes right up to room 237, is like,
he sure does.
What's this tantalizing room?
Okay, so this is where I think myself and Danny would have parted ways as a child. So, while I think it's really cool that they show him, you know, playing by himself, and he's obviously used to entertaining himself, and, like, you know, he is an only child, he rides right past room 237, and you can very clearly
tell. Stops,
yeah.
Backs up, and goes for it, and yeah. You're like, oh, let me try this door out.
Oh, yeah, like, he's thinking about it, you can tell he's getting a weird impression from it,
now,
he tries to
open
the door.
I get the idea of being curious, especially with the whole Shining ability,
yeah.
I understand that, but I almost wish that instead of it just being Danny as a kid almost seeming curious, I would almost like it more if he was drawn to the room by some sort of shining force, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that would have been cool. That's an interesting idea.
Because that would almost explain why he's into there, because
yeah.
For me, as a kid, there was no way in hell. If I'm in a giant hotel by myself, and someone has just told me, hey, weird things have happened at this hotel, and you particularly don't want to go to this room, I'd have been like, oh, there's that creepy room. Not gonna go there.
Yeah.
We got the really iconic hedge maze scene,
yes.
Where I really do love this one in terms of just, like, a cinematic shot.
Yeah.
This is by far one of the best things, I think, that best shots of the film, aside from the aerial at the beginning. The way that they kind of go into, there's a miniature inside the hotel that
mm-hmm.
Jack is looking at, and it kind of zooms in on it, and it becomes the actual real hedge maze that we see Danny and Wendy are going through.
Yeah, it morphs into the real aerial shot of the actual hedge maze that Wendy and Danny are walking through. They choose to just do the maze one
for
afternoon.
Fun right now.
For fun.
Right
yeah.
now.
Right now.
For now.
Later, it won't be for fun. What's really cool about that, so as a side note from that, actually, we were in London, England on a trip, and we did go to the Stanley Kubrick exhibit that was in one of the London museums, and we actually got to see
the original hedge maze,
that exact
diorama
miniature.
Yeah,
really, really cool, really well done.
But I do like how it does move along pretty quick from this point onwards.
Yes.
Like, Jack starts getting increasingly irritable, and
mm-hmm.
we don't necessarily know why, but we do have all these facts from the exposition that we know about the hotel, and I do like that they kind of, it's not immediate crazy.
Yeah.
It starts off more normal. He's having writer's block. He's having a hard time. He's getting a little more antsy. He's getting more irritated.
Mm-hmm.
This is where I start to find it a little more acceptable that he's getting a little more edgy with the family.
Yeah.
Not in the car ride.
No.
But now I'm okay with it.
Yeah. Finally, it's okay for Jack's character to be edgy. I think next what we should talk about is the first big scene where Jack really blows up at Wendy.
Yeah, we start really seeing something's really wrong.
Something is affecting Jack for sure. Now, unfortunately, you can say that I think where critiques of this scene are that there's not enough of a change. So if Jack at the beginning of the movie had been nicer, this blow-up scene might have
more impact.
Even more impactful. I totally agree. Essentially, what's happening is you can hear Jack, he's typing away. It's nice. It's like fast-paced typing. Type, 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 type. It's that old typewriter sound. And then Wendy comes in and she's like, hi, hun. And it just sort of, the music just comes to a crashing halt. Even the background score lines up really well with it, and I think that's cool. And he just looks at her and he's like, Like, he is, you can visibly tell, frustrated. He is visibly frustrated already just by her being like, hi, hun. That's it. All she had to say was hi, and he is pissed Done. Off. And so then he goes on this long blow up where he's like, Wendy, he's like, you know, whether you
I'm hear me. I'm trying to work.
He's like, I'm trying to work. And he's like, whether you hear me typing, type, ta, ta, ta. And he's like typing really exaggerated sarcastically. And he's like, or whether you don't hear me typing or whatever the fuck you hear me doing in here, stay out. And he's like, leave me alone. It is the perfect ramp up because it comes out of nowhere enough, but also, you know, like, he feels this isolation now, and he feels whatever is happening in the hotel.
Now, this is where I don't necessarily love, again, the portrayal of Wendy. Because she's a sort of, like, again, damsel in distress, has no backbone, when clearly she does enough to, like, care for Danny, protect him, and, like, wants this family unit to work, but I don't necessarily love that she's just like, okay, and just kind of, like...
She's hurt by it. You can tell that she's upset at this blow up. Like, she's standing there and she looks upset.
Distressed,
that wouldn't have been my reaction. I can tell you that. Like, if somebody had...
If someone had just snapped at you like that when, as far as we know, there had been no previous event like this.
Now, it does go... Maybe it's intentional. Maybe they're trying to say about her character is that... She is really too passive. She's too much of a pushover. Yeah, like, maybe it's not really a directing or character flaw. Like, maybe it really is.
Just the character of Wendy, possibly.
They're trying to just say that is just the character of Wendy. She's a good mother, but she doesn't have a backbone.
Yeah, it's possible.
It's possible. It's entirely possible. I'm kind of opposed to you in that sense that I actually like... She just kind of stands there. She doesn't even really speak up for herself. I actually do think it goes to show just kind of how weak she is in this relationship. Not a weak person, just in the relationship. Yeah, she doesn't have a voice.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
Well, now we get Shining scene. Well, one of three Shining scenes.
Yeah, so again, I think you could really chalk this up into an iconic Shining scene. And this is the scene where, so Danny, again, he's on his little big wheel, his little tricycle, he's riding throughout the hotel. He's very clearly now in a different section of the hotel, which I think is cool. They do a really good job at stylizing-wise, showing you when they're in the...
when they're in, like, their wing, or when he's on a different floor.
Or when they're in the employees' quarters, or when they're in the, just the regular part of the hotel.
Yeah.
And I think this is one where they're actually in employees' quarters, which I think is... intentional, actually. So kind of a cool idea. So he comes around the corner, and this is where he sees the twins. Not only does he see the twins, but this is the first time that they talk to him. So you get the voiceover of,
you know, come play with us, Danny.
Forever.
And ever.
And ever. And as they're saying more and more and more, it's giving you these hard cuts of scenes where the girls are now bloody and clearly have been axed to bits.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know if we touched on this earlier, but back before the hotel walkthrough, we got the first view of the twins when he's in the parlor or in the game room.
Yes, this is actually technically the second time he's seen the twins, but this is ramped up.
Yeah.
Because the first time he sees the twins, he just sees them, and they walk away. That's it. Now, it's a great shot. I know you love this shot.
Oh, yeah, where they are showing you what's happening behind, but the character doesn't know.
Yeah.
I like it when you can actually, like, your own mind kind of creates the anxiety of, you know what's there, and
you know,
go,
something's
coming.
Yeah.
But you don't know when and how.
And you also don't know if the character in the movie knows yet, and you're like, oh my god, something's there.
Well, and that's why I think this around the corner technique is so dramatic, because you saw them so creepily the first time that when he rounds the corner and they're just standing there.
And they're just, boom, all of a sudden they're there.
In center frame, like,
right
in the middle of the picture, and Danny's terrified.
Oh, yeah. Then from this point, like, after Danny sees the twins, it
ramps up
exponentially from this point. So after this, you get a pretty big change in the movie.
Jack has a nightmare about certain events.
So Jack is sort of, again, he's in his sort of workspace, which is this sort of grand hall. and he is having a nightmare, and Wendy comes and sort of wakes him up, half wakes him up out of the nightmare, half consoling him, and he is retelling a story that his nightmare was about him killing Wendy and Danny and chopping them up into little bits, and he's
hashtag foreshadowing.
Yeah, hashtag foreshadowing, and he's very clearly, like, extremely disturbed by this. Also, what I like by this scene is that he is disturbed by this. Like that he's not, like,
he's still not totally fully crazy taken over yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
I also do like that there's a bit of back and forth. There's kind of Jack's story and then there's Danny's story. And yeah. It's kind of plays both side by side, because after Danny sees the twins, he runs away, but inadvertently runs into room 237.
You can tell that not very much time has passed, and what happens is at the same time stuff is happening to Danny, but you don't fully know what is happening to Danny. So Wendy is in the process of consoling Jack, and they're kind of crouched on the floor underneath his desk, his work desk, and from Danny's perspective, the camera is just behind Danny, and he's walking very, very slowly into this giant great hall where Jack's workspace is. And he is sucking his thumb, and he's not talking.
He doesn't say a word.
He does not say a single word in this scene.
And again, I do love the fact that you don't see what happened to Danny in room 237.
No, until later.
Until later, where you kind of get an idea of what might have happened. But again, I love that the idea of this in terms of the horror genre is letting the audience figure out, or letting the audience devise what possibly could have happened to it, because I feel like that's almost scarier than what any director can show you on screen.
Isn't your imagination just so much more powerful than what a movie can show you? Sometimes a movie will ruin itself by showing you the monster.
Or showing you too much.
Exactly. So basically you have Danny walking in, he's quiet, he's not saying a word, he is sucking his thumb, and basically Wendy's calling out to him, and she's like, Danny, go play in your room. Like, turn around, go back, because she doesn't want him, I don't think she wants him seeing what the Jack conflict, is saying, the talk about the nightmare, which, rightfully so, and he's not listening, he's just very slowly still walking towards them. So then she says, you know what, hold on, Jack, I'm just gonna go see what's up, and she runs over to Danny. Well, as soon as she runs over to Danny, she sees that he's got this great big rip in his sweater. She moves his head. He's still sucking his thumb, but she moves his head, and she can see all these, like, this hand impression mark on his neck.
Yeah.
It's pretty obvious that something big has just happened. Now, you're not sure what, because maybe you're thinking, maybe Jack has hurt him, and he doesn't realize it, but you're not really sure.
And Wendy accuses Jack at this point, so she runs off with Danny, and Jack ends up going in frustration.
And as she's walking off, she's like, you hurt him, what did you do to him? And Jack is actually confused, because he's like, what? Like, he has this sort of what look on his face, because legitimately, you do find out, Jack actually hasn't hurt him at this point. It was something else, which is, again, even creepier.
This is where we start getting a little bit more information about the hotel, because now we're seeing that Jack is starting to have visions in the ballroom.
Yes.
Because he proceeds to the ballroom, and he's really thinking about going back to alcohol. He's having a hard time struggling.
And this is one of my absolute most favorite scenes. Jack leaves. He's frustrated. He is really pissed off, and he is just walking in the hotel, and he's like, he's visibly angry, he's kind of like air punching and air kicking a little bit, and he's just like, ugh! And he walks into the Pink and Cold ballroom, and he sits down
at the bar,
which is dark. All of a sudden, he looks up, you're just looking right at Jack, and he looks up, and he smiles, not at the camera, but at something that's standing right in front of him. This is where you see Lloyd, the bartender.
And he's the only one in this room. Yep.
And he's like, hi, Lloyd. Yeah.
My first impression of this is, I do like that as a person kind of first seeing this movie,
mm-hmm.
I was very much like, is this something Jack's made up?
Yeah.
Is he crazy? Is it actually happening? Air quote, like, is it the hotel?
Mm.
I do like that at this point, you don't necessarily know. You can probably go either way with it, with the information you have. Is Jack just kind of losing his mind, as in a cabin fever situation, like you think it is from the beginning?
Yes.
Or is it more of a haunting spirit situation?
Yeah, I just love that scene too. It's a very iconic scene. If, again, if you're a fan of the movie, you probably somewhat enjoy this scene for what it is. He has this kind of neat back and forth exchange with Lloyd. You know, he explains that he's got cash on him, and he's like, yeah, here's to, you know, 5 or 6 long months of sobriety, and he's like, he starts drinking. And you know, logically, that there's no alcohol in sight, but there he is.
Yeah.
Drinking
scotch, I think it was, or something. Whiskey,
I think.
Whiskey or bourbon, I can't remember.
Yeah. And he is telling Lloyd how pissed off he is with Wendy, especially. And he's saying, like, I didn't hurt him. And he's like, okay, I hurt him that one time. And it's also great acting. Like Jack Nicholson is just so expressive in those moments. He's like, a little bit funny, but he's also, like, very edgy. And he is just... he's doing a really good job. Like, with the scene, it's an excellent scene.
And I find it's, like, again, it's enough information that you get Jack's point of view, but it's also not too much that it drags on too long. Again, yes. I find the latter half of this movie does move at a pretty quick pace. The pacing
is really well done. Yeah. You haven't seen it being explained from Danny's side yet, but all you know is that Wendy bursts into the Golden Pink Ballroom, and she interrupts Jack. So she interrupts him, and he's sort of jolted out of his... moment with Lloyd, and she's explaining the whole thing. She says, there's someone in the hotel.
Yeah, well, I believe you, it wasn't you.
Yeah,
there was someone in room 237 that did this to Danny.
Yeah, and she heard him, and Danny said that, you know, she was in room 237 and all the seven. She's like, I want to go check it out. And and you can tell that he is disbelieving. Like, he's gonna do it, but he doesn't really think that this is happening. He's like, okay. He does it, though. So then Jack goes to check out room 237, and then this is where we see, again, this is another extremely iconic Shining scene. This is the, whatever you want to call her, but she's the bathtub lady. He goes to the room. The door is already open. The key is in the door handle, or in the actual lock itself. And Jack goes in, and...
and again, a really good use of shots here, the way that they kind of keep it really wide. You're seeing a lot of the room.
Yeah.
Again, you don't know if and when something is going to come out, or what you're going to see around the next corner. And there's also so much that you're looking at.
Yeah.
I do like that style of shot, especially in the horror, where they either allude to a certain position that you can see something, or they also give you so much of empty a room space. That is empty, and you don't know what you should be looking at.
Yeah, it's unnerving. It's unnerving to see that in horror movies when it's done really well. And this scene is done, like, particularly
well. And again, we come around and we see the bathtub, and that's where we see the shadow. We see her standing up and getting out of the bathtub.
She stands up. She very slowly, very carefully pulls the curtain back. She steps out of the tub super slowly, one leg and then another leg, and she walks up to Jack. And they have, they actually kiss, so they're kind of like...
kind of okay again.
Making out, and she's fully, fully, full frontal nudity here. She's completely, completely naked. And they're making out, and he's you know, he's got his hands on her. And then, again, the way the scene is shot is so good, because all of a sudden, it's sort of zoomed in on her face, right?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you can tell, that's not the same girl.
Yeah, like, that's something different.
And then it starts zooming back, and you can see... and he inhales really sharply, and he starts yelling, and he's like, ah, ah, and he realizes that he is kissing and making out with this old lady who is rotting.
Yeah.
Like, flesh rotting off the bones, and you can tell he looks nauseous, like, he's like, ugh, like, it's...
now, this
it's
part,
a very retching scene.
This part after this is where I really would wonder what's going on. I think this is one scene that might need a little bit more explanation for me.
Yeah.
Is the fact that he goes back and then says nothing. He's like, oh, yeah, there's no one there. Totally fine.
Yeah.
I'm like, if you were that terrified of something.
Yeah.
Like, you know, things didn't scare men back then.
Yeah. I don't think that's it, though. I have to kind of disagree with that. I think what's happening in that scene after he meets and makes out with the rotting lady is that he wants to keep... Wendy and Danny from leaving the hotel. So I think there's a fight between, like, logical Jack that's still around and the Jack that's being taken over by the spirits or whatever is happening at this hotel. And I think the part that's being taken over by the spirits...
is, like, edging out.
Is edging out and yeah. wanting to keep everybody there. But if you tell... I mean, imagine what the ramifications are. Let's say you're Jack and you want to keep your wife and kid there at this hotel. Well, what are you going to tell them? That you just saw, like, a rotting lady that, like, physically made out with you? Or are you going to say you said nothing?
Well, yeah, keep them there, and then maybe you can kill them later.
Right? The spirits had already taken over so much that they wanted to kill Wendy and Danny that they're going to say, through Jack, they're going to say whatever they want to keep them at the hotel.
Yeah, that's true.
Especially where it's already hurt Danny.
Well, then we get to the other ghosts in the ballroom.
Yes. Back to the ballroom. Jack is gone back to the ballroom. Oh, no, sorry. We are skipping ahead a little bit. He goes back and tells Wendy, I didn't see anything. And she's saying, well, that, like, Wendy is confused. It doesn't make any sense. Something has to have hurt Danny. And basically, Jack suggests, well, when you rule out his version of the events, then basically Jack is accusing Danny of making it all up, or that it's all in his head. I don't think she's fully made up her mind on if it's real or not real, but she does not care. She just wants to get out of there. So she's like, I think we should leave. And he's like, oh, this is so typical of you. Like, just when I'm getting going in my writing, you know, you're gonna have to pull this shit on me. This is where Jack storms out of their little apartment in the hotel.
In the hotel.
In his storming out, he goes back to the ballroom. And when he goes back to the ballroom, it is in full-blown 1920s party mode. I think it is one of the coolest scenes ever shot. He goes up to the bar, he sees Lloyd once again, and he says, you know, what'll it be? And Jack says, you know, hair of the dog. And, you know, he pours him the same old drink.
Okay, so Jack's going along with this party.
Yeah. Just as he's sort of, like, backing up and he's sort of going to start walking through and sort of meandering through the party a little bit, this gentleman dressed up in a butler's outfit, what looks like, bumps into him and he gets some, you know, stuff on Jack's jacket. And he says, oh, he's so sorry, and he's tripping all over himself. And he's like, okay, come into the bathroom and we'll wash that right off. Then you get the kind of very infamous, that scene that takes place in the gentleman's bathroom. It's that completely red bathroom. And that's where you find out that this is Delbert Grady. Delbert Grady is the, or was the, caretaker who killed his family all those years ago. Jack confronts him. He actually says, you know, Delbert Grady? You're Delbert Grady? Because he's kind of remembering the story that he's heard about this guy. It's kind of some brutal language. Like, Delbert Grady uses the N-word, right? In reference to Dick Halloran.
Dick Halloran, yeah.
Simultaneously, again, we've kind of talked about this, is that they have that sort of two stories going on at the same time. So what's happening behind the scene is that Danny is now trying to get help from Dick Halloran using The Shining. This is when Delbert Grady takes it upon himself to tell Jack that his son is
seeking outside help,
and that's when he refers to him as the N-word cook. So it's pretty harsh, like, pretty harsh language, but you're also not supposed to like Delbert Grady at all. Like, he is, you know.
Now, part of that is, I don't know the 70s that well. Was that even socially acceptable then?
Not really.
Not really?
Still not really. I mean, I guess...
possibly more so.
If you have to say more socially acceptable than right now, sure. But still not good. Still not appropriate.
Again, in this, I do like the idea of the jumping back and forth of the scenes.
Sorry to interrupt, but I do think that to your point of, no, maybe it's not appropriate for the 70s, but what you have to remember is that Delbert Grady is even older, right? So Delbert Grady... definitely, first of all, he looks older. He looks like he's a gentleman in his late 50s, maybe early 60s, age-wise.
Well, and you assume that was when he died. And you're assuming 20, 30 years ago.
Well, 10 years ago, I guess. No, it was 10 years ago. Yeah. And you're assuming that he died 10 years ago. But that still puts him at a you know, his birthday was around early 1900s. That's, yeah. You know, I'm not trying to excuse that at all, but maybe they're trying to make it seem obvious that Delbert Grady is from an earlier time. He's an older man from an earlier time.
Yeah, that's possible.
Right? Like, maybe that's why it's so jarring in that scene. That's pretty much it to that scene. It's a pretty creepy scene, but he also lets on this big piece of information where Delbert Grady says to him, "No, I'm not the caretaker. You're the caretaker. You've always been the caretaker," which is huge foreshadowing for the absolute last shot of the movie. However, in that moment, it's just confusing because I haven't really delved into that particular subject yet.
"I'm sorry to differ with you, sir. But you are the caretaker. You've always been the caretaker. I should know, sir. I've always been here."
Now, going back to the Stephen King work, did that original ending, kind of skipping ahead here, I know, was that the original ending of the book?
No, that he was the original caretaker?
Not the original caretaker, but, you know, that kind of, does it end in the idea of, you know, the zooming in on the picture?
No.
No?
No, from what I understand, this scene is very much in reference to the very last scene of the movie. If you've seen the last scene of the movie, it's that really great shot of all the craziness has happened and the super creepy music is playing in the background and they're zooming into this old-timey 1920s era
photo. Picture of the gala, of the 1920 exactly. gala.
And Jack is very much dressed up in period tuxedo clothing, and he's standing right in front of this big group of people, again making it seem like he's always been there, or he was always supposed to be there. Great shot, but so fun fact of what I learned about that shot, actually Stanley Kubrick had to be convinced to even put that into the final edit of the movie. He actually didn't really care for it. He was like, "Oh, it doesn't really make sense." And they were like, "No, it does make sense because of this previous scene, of this previous bathroom scene. That's mm-hmm. why it makes sense."
Okay, so speaking back to more iconic scenes, we start now getting the Red yeah. Rum scene, which musician, I always see it as re-drum, but...
Yeah. The Red Rum scene. So basically, at this point, Wendy, again, good work as a mom, she decides to leave. She's like, "You know what? I don't care. Something is happening here. I don't like it. It's hurt my son. Whatever it is, it's hurt my son." And then you get kind of the very famous Red Rum scene.
Yeah, where the night before she's planning to leave.
Yeah.
Tony through Danny has scribbled the words Red Rum on the
and
on one of the doors in the apartment.
And it's a good scene because it's nice and slow. So it's got some really slow pacing to it. Danny picks up this long knife that Wendy had been keeping, I think, just for protection purposes. So he picks up this long knife off of her dresser. He goes over to the door, grabs her lipstick, and he writes Red Rum on the door so that you, when she wakes up and hears him screaming Red Rum, Red Rum, Red Rum over and over again, she looks in the mirror and it says murder. That's the whole thing. So then she's...
Good job, Stephen King.
Yeah.
Tough to decipher.
Yeah. Then we get, again, what is like the... This is now the next couple scenes.
The quintessential Shining scenes. Just going back to the Red Rum scene.
Yeah.
I like the voice of Tony. I just find it has that kind of annoying 70s quality.
Yeah.
A kind of tinny. Again, maybe I'm just kind of complaining. I have opinions about technology at the time.
Well, because all they were doing was just getting Danny, the real person, to put on like a little voice, right?
Yeah, but I also know that 70s recording equipment was not the best.
It is very tinny. Yeah,
it's he's very just tinny. It's just like
Red Rum, Red Rum, Red Rum, Red Rum, Red Rum, Red Rum.
Yeah, it's a little obnoxious. I think that you could say like,
now it doesn't bring the storyline down, no. But it is just a little jarring through modern modern ears.
And then from this point on, Jack is full crazy. Really?
And speaking of full crazy, the next scene where we figure out that Jack's a bit of a dull boy, so to say the least.
Yeah.
That is a really great scene. I mean, it you couldn't have picked a better way to depict that scene where you are just seeing the mounds of paper of how many times he's written that out.
I mean, I love it. It really...
And the full, like, mental breakdown of Jack in that scene.
And I love that, like, she flips through the papers and flips and flips and flips and flips. Like, they don't just show you, oh, a stack of papers and you're supposed to infer that there's writing on each one of those papers. She's flipping through frantically, showing you these pages after pages after pages of all work and no play make Jack a dull boy. And it is really well done, because she's flipping through and she's just getting increasingly freaked out, and she's like, oh my god, this is what he's been doing this whole time. Like,
I wonder what intern had to type all those.
Yeah.
Poor interns.
So I heard that for the English version of that, actually Kubrick did most of it.
Ah, good for him.
Also, fun fact, for some of the translated versions of the movies, they actually had those typed words redone in other languages.
Hmm.
Yeah, for different translated versions of the movie, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah. Now, this is where I don't love the direction they went with Wendy.
Oh, yeah.
The pathetic bat swings and the just weepy crying.
Yeah. So, okay, so here's what I love and don't love about it. I have to completely agree with you. I hate her acting, or at least the direction they went with her acting in this scene, and I love Jack's acting. Because
that's the thing I don't get, though, is they got such a great performance out of Jack Nicholson. And then out of Shelley Duvall, it's just like, I don't know if this is what they were intending, but this whole, like,
And cause
bat swings. And she's just, like, pathetically swinging this bat at Jack.
Yeah, yeah. And she's like,
as soon as possible, as soon as possible, Jack.
It's that sort of that crying, can't catch your breath, which I get.
I get you can be frustrated, you can be scared, you can be terrified, but at least a little stoic. I mean, you're planning to run away with your kid.
Yeah. And I mean, you've already made this decision. It's very odd to me. So, and Jack's acting is unbelievable, because he looks her square in the eyes and he tells her he's gonna bash her brains in. You know, and he's got a smirk on his face, and he's got his crazy eyebrows on the go, and you're just like, it's very well done. Like, it's a great performance from him. And for that, I will say that, like, even despite her acting or the direction of her
acting,
it still
makes a really great scene, and really is kind of like a key moment in the movie.
Oh, it's a key moment, because then now she's not just questioning herself or thinking, oh, am I making the right decision? Oh, no, he's gone full crazy. He wants to kill both of them.
Yeah,
and that's just it. And then from there,
well, and then
you
for Wendy, because she locks him in the pantry.
Yeah, so they're famously on the stairs. She knocks him out, and you have to say, good job, because not all of the damsel in distress roles get that opportunity to actually knock the bad guy out.
Especially considering how Stanley Kubrick was kind of treating Shelley.
And quite critical of her and everything. And so she knocks him out, and really clever, really freaking clever, she drags him to the pantry. And again, I have to say, that's one of those moments where you're going, yes, like, you're really rooting for her, because you're like, that's a good decision. Like,
and then earlier, I don't know when this happened exactly, but then, like, the calling on the radios, trying to make sure that's all good.
I mean, because she had gone through the whole movie. We didn't so much talk about this, because there's a lot to the movie that we can't really discuss and take hours and hours.
There's already so much we're going into.
Yeah. But, like, throughout the movie, she knows that the phone lines are down. She knows how to operate that snowcat machine. She makes sure to contact those, I don't know if they're mountain rangers
or something.
Something
like that.
They're a type of police, you know, presence. So she's actually not stupid. Like, she's not a dumb character.
No.
It's just that she is a little weak. She's a little on the weak side, weak-willed, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I absolutely love that Wendy drags an unconscious Jack into that pantry. She's not trying to kill him, but she is very much going to contain him. Often in horror movies, how many times are you watching a horror movie and you see people doing dumb things like running to an attic or running to a basement, and you're like, no.
No one would ever do that.
Yeah, no one would ever do that. The killer's gonna get you. And so I really love that. Like, I think it's awesome. Now, it doesn't last long because...
Those stupid Overlook ghosts.
Yeah, because the Overlook ghosts actually let Jack out, which is... Then it just confirms that there are actually ghosts. Yeah. That's the kind of... I think that's what they're trying to get at.
That's the idea they're going for, yeah. Well, which leads us to our next really famous scene.
Yes. So then Jack gets himself... So he's got an axe, and he comes to their apartment door, and first he bashes... He's bashing down the apartment door with an axe. He gets into the apartment, and Wendy has barricaded herself with Danny in the little apartment bathroom. And Jack, what does he say? He goes,
little pigs, let me come in. Not by the hair on your chinny chin chin. Then I'll huff, and I'll puff, and I'll blow your house in.
Playing off the old nursery rhyme kind of thing. And so there he is, just axing his way through the door.
Here's Johnny.
And again, good for Wendy. She does two really great things here.
She gets Danny out the window.
She gets Danny out the window, which you have to
say. She does try herself.
She tries herself, but she's too big. She's not going to fit through the window. And you can't fault her for that. She tried.
But she did grab a knife.
But she grabbed a knife.
And she hid by the door, ready for him to come in.
Exactly. And she cuts him really good on the hand when he's going to stick his hand in, trying to unlock the door. Yeah, right? So, like, she does a good job with that.
Well, so Jack gets distracted because he hears a snowcat coming up because he disabled the other one.
Yes.
This is where I feel bad. You're like, yeah, I'm really glad that Jack got distracted enough, but you know it's only because Dick came on the scene to save him.
Yeah.
And only for Dick to get slashed by an axe and killed.
Dick Halloran this whole time has been finding his way... So he was
from Florida,
a flight all the way to Denver, and then a rental car to drive to some smaller town, and then renting a snowcat.
Convinced a friend to get a snowcat up to the mountain so he could try to save the family.
And then this man just shows up. Yeah, drives up in a snowcat just in the nick of time, you know, when stuff is really going down.
Just to have Jack come by, hide behind as he walks through the foyer and get an axe to the chest.
And he gets an axe to the chest and dies. It's technically speaking, Dick Halloran is the only person that Jack actually murders.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
To be fair, Dick did do his purpose.
Yes.
He did get Wendy and Danny safe.
He did. I mean, he's full on saved their life. It gave them enough time so that Wendy was able to get Danny to a safer place and she got out of the bathroom. I do think that had he not rolled up in that moment, I'm sure she would have been killed. Danny might have been okay because he was already out of the bathroom at that point.
Mm. Now, just shortly after this, we have one of my weaker scenes where Jack has been led out to the maze by Danny.
Yes.
And we have now Wendy, who has finally made her way out of the apartment,
frantically running around.
And we just have dead skeletons.
Yeah. So, well, no. Before you get the skeletons,
yes,
hold on.
Yes, you do get the ballroom burr first.
So you get some things that are cool, and then you get some things that are just hella confusing.
Yes.
And then you get kind of some cheese also. So basically, you get a number of scenes where Wendy is just sort of running around. And I don't love the way that she's running around. She's just sort of...
She's kind of like running around random parts of the hotel after knowing your kid has escaped outside.
Yeah, like if you're smart enough to push your kid out the window, they safely get down. Yeah, and that's all well and good. Wouldn't you be making your way fastest way possible outside to get to the kid? I would think
so.
Makes
sense. As opposed, you're just going to wander around every room in the hotel just because.
She's just sort of aimlessly running around the hotel, sniffle crying, and she sees various things. So I think the first thing that she sees is just a fully confusing image to me. The first time I saw this movie, I didn't know what it was. the all of the subsequent times of seeing this movie, I even now, I guess I know what it is. I don't know the context. I don't fully understand it. Maybe you can have some insight to this. But so basically, it's one man who's in, I don't know, what looks like a bear costume, and another man who is dressed up fancy in like what looks like a tuxedo. And the other man is, the bear suit man, is clearly on his knees performing oral sex. I don't...
Stanley Kubrick's a weirdo thought that's what every guy was doing in the 1920s?
I don't know. Like, I don't know its significance to this story.
I don't know if it has significance to the story. Maybe it's just one of those things where he's trying to relay, like, it's a party and...
Party stuff happens.
Could have happened at a party.
And people have sex during parties.
In bear costumes in a 1920s party.
I don't get that. I don't get the bear costume.
I don't get the bear costume.
I think it would have almost made more sense to me had it just been two gentlemen dressed in tuxes.
Yeah.
Then it would be like, oh, they snuck off out of the party to go...
Well, maybe there was a bear convention nearby. Who knows?
It just doesn't make any sense to me. It's the one thing where I'm like, okay, cool.
Fun fact, Stanley Kubrick.
Thanks. So she's freaked out by that. She runs away. She sees decorations everywhere. And I think the decorations are really cool because it's like the Overlook Hotel is letting her in on seeing some of these things now.
Yes, because to this point, Wendy hasn't seen anything.
Yeah, she really hasn't seen anything. She sees the elevator doors and the blood. Again, really cool tie-in to what Danny has been seeing. Yeah. She sees the gentleman who clearly has like... a cut or something on his head.
Yep.
The blood is like dripping down his face and he's holding like a scotch glass or something. He's holding a drink and he's like, nice party, yay, or something like that.
I know, but then going back to my recording, you run into the skeletons, which I'm like, okay, you just showed everyone as like normal human.
Yeah, normal humans. Like not ghosts. They're just, you understand that they're ghosts. You understand that they're, but they look essentially like you and me. They look like normal.
They look like normal humans.
Humans.
And then you get to like just really bad 70s, like bad Halloween cheese skeletons.
Yeah, it's cheese.
I feel like a better way would have been to have done it similarly to the rest of it, where you had maybe a bunch of people in normal period clothing that maybe have like sunken in skin, have blood, have something where you know they're clearly supposed to look dead.
Or done it closer to the bathtub lady.
Yes.
Where she very clearly had like rotting flesh on her. And like, to be fair, the makeup artist who did her stuff was phenomenal because that looked really, really realistic. But those skeletons...
Not so much. We're going to skip to the non-Stephen King ending of The Maze.
Yes.
Now, for some of you that don't know, the original ending is Danny lures Jack to the boiler room.
Yeah.
Where he lets the boiler loose and the boilers explode.
Yeah. And Jack. And both... In Stephen King's version, both Danny and his mother do make it out alive.
Yes.
So in that regard...
The outcome hasn't changed.
Yeah, the number of people living to the people who get killed at the hotel are the same. In the boiler room exploding, the King version, it technically destroys the hotel, which I find is, I guess, it's a point for Danny because it's a more clever version of... You know, Danny's not only outsmarting his father in that situation, but he's outsmarting, like, the hotel in general. Like, he's actually managed to destroy the hotel. Which is, it's very clever. But me personally, I actually prefer the movie ending.
Yeah, I do like the movie ending, too, because you then need to see a little bit more wit from Danny.
Yes.
Because up until this point, Danny has just been Tony and a normal kid.
Yeah.
And, you know... As a kid, I think it's really clever that you followed and backstepped your own footprints.
Again, it's one of those rare horror movie moments where you get to go, oh, right on. He is massively outsmarting this man right now. And he did. So, again, for those of you who know and the ones that don't, but probably everybody knows, Danny leads Jack into the hedge maze, the famous hedge maze. And now it's snowing, right? So this is middle of winter. There's already snow on the ground. And so Jack is in there. He's chasing after him. He's yelling, Danny. And, you know, it's pretty frightening.
And you can tell by the shots that Jack is looking up and down, following Danny's footprints.
Yes.
Through the maze.
And Danny, like, Danny leads him a fair way into this maze. And then he kind of realizes, like, oh, crap, I'm leaving footprints. That's how he's still following me. And so Danny gets this absolutely brilliant idea to backtrack his footprint. So he very carefully
he follows the dead end and then walks backwards, not to make new footprints, and then hides in a bush.
Yeah, and then he hides in a bush and he sort of sweeps away the prints of the new prints that he's just made. And then he very promptly gets the hell out of there.
Yeah.
Like, he actually
using his footprints
using
to
his own footprints.
Exit.
Yeah.
Which, like, is a really smart thing for a kid to do.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, I absolutely love it. Because it's like, again, oftentimes in movies, it makes kids look either, like, too childish or, you know. But I think this is an amount of clever that you could actually
you
imagine
could expect from a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's great. And again, it's that rare horror movie moment where you get to just super root for the good guy.
Yeah.
And you are. You know.
And I do just like how the maze kind of ends up a lot better than the mm-hmm. boiler room, because then you still have the hotel, and
yeah.
then the ending scene where we actually see the picture in
yes.
the hotel makes a lot more sense.
It does make a lot more sense. So then flash forward to you get Danny escaping from the maze. He meets up with his mom, and luckily, because Dick Halloran had originally tried to come and rescue them,
they have his snow cat.
Yeah, they get
to go back down.
Exactly. They get to escape away in his snow cat and safely get back into the city. And then, again, that very, very last, sort of second-to-last scene, it shows Jack frozen to death outside in the maze, trapped in the maze.
Then you walk through the hotel,
yeah.
and you see the last photo.
And then you see the last photo. The great
I
song
like
that ends
that is
it
a
out.
Nice, I do like that that's kind of a nice tie-in of, like, this was your fate
yes.
the whole time.
Yes.
I do like that addition from the original story, too,
yeah.
For the movie.
And almost like Jack is supposed to be a part of this weird ghost crew at this very scary hotel.
Well, and I like, too, that it ended up, you know, foreshadowing to another movie that we'll probably get to, into
yes.
Dr. Sleep.
Dr. Sleep, yeah.
You do see that it does have a lot more tie-ins than...
It does.
It would than in this original universe.
Yeah, it does. You can clearly see that Kubrick liked the source material, but he really took it and made it his own.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Now, let's do a quick general little wrap up here.
Okay.
My general thoughts are really great storyline. I
yeah.
love the additions. I love the way it shot. I love mm-hmm. how it kind of almost carved the way for some
yes.
horror techniques that have really made its way in, those dramatic cuts, the different camera angles.
Yeah.
Even music-wise, there are some weird sound effects that
yeah.
have now been kind of common knowledge, you know, pre-electronic music,
yeah.
of course, for scores,
mm-hmm.
Which I really do love in this, even though it's not necessarily all original work. But I have to say, overall, it gives a strong positive for me. The only downside and critiques I have on it, as you know...
That one
I love
cheesy
Shelley
scene.
Duvall.
Yeah.
I love Shelley Duvall, just a little weak on her character.
Yes.
And just some of the 70s cheese. Like some of the,
yeah.
again, I can't fault them for the technology. That's,
yeah.
they had to do what they had to do.
He's working with what he had.
But the skeletons.
I know. I know.
I can't.
For me, yeah. And for me, I have to like, really, I think I actually have to completely agree. I love how it's shot. I think it very much is a first of its kind of doing that sort of making you feel very creeped out about the empty space that they're showing or not showing in the scene or in the shot. I think it's really cool. That honestly, not everybody does, and not everybody does well.
Mm-hmm.
We have a couple of modern favorites that I think really take after The Shining in this way. And we'll kind of get to those episodes when we do. I love, for the most part, the casting of this movie. I think it is extremely well done. Like, Jack Nicholson is just...
Yeah.
Can you even imagine anyone else?
No, it's so iconic now that
yeah.
you can't imagine anyone else in that character.
You can't even imagine anyone else in that character. I think he does a freaking phenomenal job. Danny does a great
yeah,
job.
For a child actor,
it is
a
rare,
really good job.
Yes, it is rare for me to really even like a child actor, and boy, he does it so well. And I know a lot of that does have to go to credit to Kubrick because of the style, the way that they got him to.
Yeah, to do
you
all
know,
those. Get that emotion
to show
out.
His emotions. And yeah, my only really downsides are just some of Wendy's, like, weak characteristics. And that stupid skeleton scene. I will never understand it's why just, that
it cheesy looks like scene. Such a bad Halloween maze.
It does. Yeah. It looks like a Halloween maze that you and I could do.
Yeah.
We could go down to a party store.
Spirit Halloween.
Yeah. And buy some fake skeletons, some plastic skeletons, and put them on our front lawn. And
that's the scene.
That would be the there caliber of that scene. And I find that so odd. It's odd in comparison to the entire body of that movie, which is just phenomenal in comparison.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. All right, so here comes our scores. So for those of you interested, we are going to be reviewing them on the following categories. Each category is going to get a total of 20 points each, and we're going to give brief reasons as to why and give you a total rating of our movie scores. So our categories for rating are overall story, the acting, visual effects, music and sound effects, and the movie ending in satisfaction. Mm-hmm. So, Ginger, who wants to go first? You want me to go?
You go first, yeah.
All right. So, for the storyline, I only gave it a 15 out of 20.
Okay.
Now, that being said, it's not a fault of Stanley Kubrick. I'm just not a huge fan of the Stephen King storylines.
It's not for everybody.
It's not necessarily my thing, but I think they did a really good job with it, hence the score.
Yep.
Now, acting, I went a little low. I gave them a 13 out of 20. Just, Jack was great. Danny's great. Shelley Duvall just brought it down.
Yeah.
And again, I don't want to say it's her. It could have just been the way that they went with her character.
Yeah, I get that.
Now for the visual effects, I also gave it a 13.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that a Stanley Kubrick movie of that caliber, especially with that skeleton scene and what they've done for the rest of the movie, that just brought it down.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I kind of expect more throughout the movie.
Yeah.
Now getting into music and sound effects, I think they nailed it.
Yeah.
The Foley, the music.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even though it's not original, and you know how I feel about original music.
I know.
They did a really good job. Edits are great with all the cuts. That's really tough to do, especially in that time. So I gave them an 18 out of 20.
And if I'm not mistaken, it was the old way of editing.
Yeah, full on, like, splicing with the razor blade. Yeah. So that would have been tricky to do.
Pretty well done.
So I did give them an 18 out of 20 there. Now, lastly, for the movie ending and satisfaction, it's got a great ending. It got an 18 out of 20 for me.
Yeah.
So they gave me a grand total of 77 out of 100, which seemed a little low to me for the movie. But
yeah, that seems a little low to me.
Maybe I'm just a harsh critic. Who knows?
I think you're pretty, I don't know, is that working in film and TV? Like, does that...
Maybe, but I also, I'm trying to keep in mind, too, that this is a 70s movie, and it's going to have issues that movies and film today are not, or movies and TV are not going to have today.
Yeah, and so in comparison, I think I went a little higher with my score. Part of that could be just because, like, oh, it's my favorite horror movie, so maybe I'm being biased. But I'm also thinking that, like, oh, compared to the time, I think it's extremely impressive. So I will say, like, we are actually pretty similar. Mm-hmm. In overall story, I ended up giving it an 18 for just that I actually do like the source material a little bit more. So I think that story does speak to me. There are little things that I didn't really care for. We've already said it. I don't like the mention of the Indian burial ground thing. It just doesn't really tie into the story for me. I find it to just be frivolous. The acting, I put it just a little bit higher than yours, but I can see where you're going. I gave it a 15 out of 20. Again, I think Jack Nicholson, unbelievable. Danny Lloyd as Danny was also fantastic. And yes, Shelley Duvall is a little weaker in her role, but I do think that even despite that, the other acting spots where she does nail it, she does a really great job. Yeah. I gave visual effects, if you will, an 18 out of 20. Again, I know that is significantly higher than yours. I just think that for the technology that he was working with, very cool.
Yeah.
Music and sound effects, I'm like you. I think he nailed it. I actually gave a perfect, like, 20 out of 20. I understand. It's not an original score, but the scenes, the edits, like, it matches up with the sound of the music so perfectly. Better than even some movies today that have this digital editing advancement. Well,
they edit too much. That's the problem.
That is the problem, isn't it? Yeah, so I think it's where the movie is. It's just phenomenal. Lastly, for me, I totally agree with you. Movie ending, satisfaction, 19 out of 20 for me. I think it is so good. I actually love the change that Kubrick made from the original source material to what actually ended up in the movie. I love the addition of the last scene, the picture scene, if you will. And the only reason I didn't give it a perfect 20 out of 20 is because that stupid skeleton scene.
The goddamn skeleton's getting us every time.
It gets me every time. I just think it's really cheesy. I think it's way, way, way below Stanley Kubrick and everything that he did in that movie. Overall, for me, that brings me to a 90 out of 100, which I think is a little closer for what you should maybe rate The Shining, Matt.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
We'll round up to an 80% for me. How about
that? Okay, there we go. I think that's really nice. Then we could split the difference. I think that's really good. Tune in next time.
Enjoy the Dark Room reviews.